I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Diane Sasson, lecturer in theology and women, about her recent book, Yearning for the New Age, Laura Holloway Langford and Late Victorian Spirituality. Diane, thanks for agreeing to do this interview.
Thanks for asking me, Chris.
Your new book naturally goes into some detail about Laura Holloway Langford's life and writings, and we'll be talking in more detail about that in the interview. But I wonder if you could just start off with a brief sketch of who Laura Holloway Langford was.
Laura Holloway Langford was a writer. She was a newspaper editor and a lecturer, and she's best known today as author of a book called Ladies of the White House that was published in 1869. That book is still used as a resource for historians for information about the lives of early first ladies. And Laura Holloway Langford was particularly interested in restoring the history of women that she felt had been neglected or overlooked, particularly women of accomplishment. And many of her writings were compilations of biographies or collections of stories by women. So she had a very strong interest in what today we would call women's history. She was one of the first women to work daily in a newsroom. Now, women before Laura Holloway Langford had written for newspapers. They had been columnists, they'd even been editors of magazines, but they did not go into a newsroom daily and work alongside men. And the hours of newsroom work were deemed inappropriate for a woman of good reputation. She would go in during the day and not get back to her home in Brooklyn until 11 or 12 o'clock at night by herself. So she first, in the early 70s, was an editor with the Brooklyn Daily Union, and then by the mid-70s had moved to the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, where she worked until the mid-1880s. And at the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, there was no such thing as a women's page, but she was the editor who was designated to cover women's issues. So she was the woman on the staff who covered women's clubs, who covered the suffrage movement, who probably covered even the Beecher Tilton scandals, and so influenced how a very prominent newspaper was covering feminist and women's issues of the period. She was also a spiritual seeker, and the focus of the book is not just on her biography per se, but is using her life as a case study for a certain kind of spiritual seeker in the late 19th and early 20th century. She, early on, abandoned her early Protestant, rather Orthodox Presbyterian religious upbringing, and began to pursue alternative religious paths. She was interested in phrenology. She was a spiritualist. She became a member of the Theosophical Society. She was always a theosophist in spirit, although she became disillusioned with the Theosophical Society. She continued to be interested in occult and theosophical studies throughout her long life, and was interested in Eastern religions, and at some point considered herself a Buddhist, although being a Buddhist in Brooklyn in the late 19th century meant mainly being a vegetarian and believing in reincarnation, and not much more than that. And she was also very much interested in the Shakers. And so several chapters in the book talk about her relationship with the Shaker community, particularly the North family of Shakers, which was the most progressive and liberal branch of the Shakers.
So that's a snapshot.
That's enough to start with.
Okay, and we'll go into detail about quite a number of those things, I think, in the interview. But to start with sort of the motivation or how this book grew out of work you've done, as you say in the final chapter of the book, where you talk about the sort of the progress of your research. Your interest in Laura Holloway Langford grew out of your work with the Shakers. So could you talk a little bit about mm-hmm. how that came about.
Yes, I had worked on, have worked on the Shakers for many years since the time of my graduate work. And I've always been interested in the North family of Lebanon, and particularly Anna White, a particular Shaker woman, who co-authored in 1904 a book called Shakerism, Its Meaning and Message, which is probably the most important book of Shaker theology and Shaker history written by a Shaker, and is really a book that has shaped how the 20th century has understood the Shakers to a great extent. So I'd always had in the back of my mind that I'd like to do research on Anna White and write something about Anna White. And Jack and I were going on sabbatical to New York in 2005 and 2006, where I would have access to archives and libraries, that material that I did not have available here in Tennessee. So I started doing some preliminary research on Anna White, preparing to spend that year working on Anna White and the North Family Shakers, and discovered in a bibliography of the Winterthur collection, the Edward Deming Andrews Shaker collection at the Winterthur Library, that Anna White had a correspondence for many decades with a woman named Laura Langford, and that Laura Langford had been born in Nashville, Tennessee. So at this point, my curiosity was piqued, and I started poking around in local libraries, the Nashville Public Library and Tennessee Archives and History, to see what I could find out about Laura. As she turns out, Laura Carter Holloway Langford. She, as I said in the book, she's a woman of many names, which is sometimes confusing. And discovered some basic information about her life, which it turns out virtually none of which was true. And as I discovered that this was a woman who had left Nashville and constructed for herself many identities, reinvented herself many times, I became more and more interested in Laura, and so that ultimately Anna White plays a relatively minor part in the book. She is the subject of one chapter, is a major character in one chapter of the book. But this project just took on a life of its own mm-hmm. from that point on.
You talk about dealing with libraries and archives, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about how a historian uses archives to reconstruct somebody's life.
Yes, I mean, one of the most exciting things about doing this project for me was really delving into archival material and into material that had not been discovered before or used by other historians or writers about the Shakers or religious history. So let me use the Winterthur in Delaware as an example, because that was one of the major archival collections that was essential for this book. And that was where, as I said before, the collection of letters that Anna White had written to Laura Langford are housed. So I visited the Winterthur knowing about that collection of letters. And those were relatively straightforward. They were dated. They're legible. They're very literate. the challenge with those letters is not in the transcription of them. That was, as I said, pretty easy to do. But the fact that Laura's letters did not survive. Mm. So you have one side of a correspondence. And this was typical because Laura kept everything. She was an inveterate writer and correspondent. She wrote constantly. But people threw her things away. And those have not survived. Very few of those letters have survived. So I had to reconstruct the letter that Laura would have written to mm-hmm. Anna White by Anna White's response. So I used archival material then to provide context to those correspondents where I was having to do imaginative reconstructions in some ways of Laura's personality and of what Laura had written. Those letters, however, would provide clues to other material. So, for example, in letters from Anna White, I might come across a reference or a reaction to a newspaper article that Laura had written about the Shakers. Mm. Anna White either approving or maybe disapproving or correcting, in times correcting the information in an article. And my challenge was then to try to find that article, which was not at all an easy thing to do, because often you didn't have the name of the newspaper. You had the date of the letter, but knew only that sometime in the weeks before that letter was written, a newspaper article had been published by Laura. And in some cases, I was able to track down then those newspaper articles. In other cases, I've not been able to. Sometimes I could verify that it was the correct article by the bit of information that Anna White had corrected in her letter. Said, you have gotten my age wrong in this letter. I am not 62. I'm 64 years old. And so you would be able to verify that was actually the article that was being discussed in the letter. In other cases, and this to me was more significant, there would be mention of books that Laura had published anonymously and that were unknown and unattributed to her. And through references in archival material, then I was able to find and track down at least two of those. Now, I realize that there may be more, and there certainly is a great deal of newspaper writing and magazine writing that she did that have no byline and that I could not identify. There are references in the archives to articles published in certain magazines. I have not been able to verify which articles were written by her. So I know there's a lot more material out there. Okay, so that's one aspect. Mm-hmm. That's one aspect of using archival material. But at the Winter Tour also, it was not just the letters of Anna White that I discovered. There were scrapbooks from Laura that she had kept of newspaper clippings. Many times those were undated, and often you did not have the name of the newspaper where they appeared. But they were often reviews of her books, her works, or items that had to do with people she knew or her interests, feminist interests. And so those help provide context for her life. And then I discovered issues of a magazine that has been virtually unknown in the bibliographic history of American publications, a magazine that Laura edited in the late 1880s. And that actually I discovered was precursor to a very well-known publication called The Woman's World, published in England, edited by Oscar Wilde. Mm. And that many of the articles that Oscar Wilde gets credit for being a feminist were actually published in Laura's magazine earlier. It's been very difficult, and I haven't been able to really trace the ins and outs. It's quite complicated of the relationship between these publications. But because there were issues of this magazine there in the archive, then this whole world began to open up of the relationship between publications and publications that were important in changing the image of women in the late 19th century. Then, in the archive, I can just go on and on. You can tell about archives, about archives. This is a question that I could talk about for the whole hour. Were these very strange letters, thin paper, written in purple ink or pencil, often in pencil, very faded, very difficult to read, undated. Undated, with strange words that you couldn't decipher, or if you did decipher, were so strange that you didn't know whether you deciphered them correctly. Sometimes scribblings in what looked like Sanskrit characters. Most of these signed KH from a Mahatma who are the wise ancient beings who theosophists believe live in remote areas of the Himalayas, who at some times pick out very spiritually advanced persons as their disciples with whom they communicate. And they communicate in writing. And the name of this particular Mahatma was Kuthomi. And Kuthomi carried on a correspondence with Laura Holloway Langford in 1884, in the summer of 1884. Now, I had known a bit about this, but as I say in the epilogue to the book, I'd really been trying to avoid working on theosophy with Laura because it was so complicated, and it was really a whole different world for me to step in to try to understand this world of the characters and the conflicts and the issues in theosophy. But I realized when I went into the Winter Tour archive that this was a central part of her life, and I simply couldn't ignore it. So I transcribed these letters And some of them, a good number of them, had been published previously. But there were differences in what I transcribed and the ones that had been published. So again, this is goes to the question of using archival material. So the question comes up, which are the original letters? And it's clear to me that the Withertour letters are the originals, and that Laura had made copies, or other people had made copies over the years that had survived in other places, and then some of these had been published. But there were changes. Who made those changes? When were they made? Why were the copies made? All that became another whole story in the saga about Laura. What was I going to say about the Kuthomi? What else to say about the Kuthomi letters?
So much
to say about these. I would say that also that these letters, the existence of these letters, and the fact that Laura received them, gives her stature in the world of theosophy, in the Theosophical Society, that she otherwise would not have had. And people recognized her importance both then and today because she received and owned these letters. The Mahatmas communicated only with a small number of people in writing, and of those, very few were women, only maybe three or four, Helena Blavatsky, who founded the society, herself, and a couple of others, and Laura. And Laura, I think, received more letters than any woman other than Blavatsky herself. So these are of significance to Theosophical history, and the fact Laura realized that these were extremely important, and some of them she kept secret for the rest of her life. These are the ones that she did not make copies of, that had not been published, and there are several in the Winterthur collection that I transcribe, that I use in the book, that have not been known before this book.
So archival work, I mean, it provides a context that complicates your life in a way, because you begin to see how complex you've got these documents, and you have to decide how they relate to other documents, and it just raises
so the task then becomes taking these, for example, using the Kuthomi letters as an example, and trying to understand them in some larger context. And then that takes you out to all the work that's been done on the history of the Theosophical Society, particularly in the early days, in the 1880s, 70s and 80s, the origin of this character. That led me not only to try to understand the particular events in 1884, but led me to think about him as a constructed character within the Theosophical narrative. And that led to looking at fiction, where he appears as a character and where Laura appears as a character. And thinking about the Mahatmas as constructions of the religious imagination and their appearance both in religious texts, our theosophical texts, and in avowedly fictional portrayals, and how they were understood by members of the Theosophical Society, and how Laura understood the Mahatmas. She believed, or at least she wrote, that one of the Mahatmas appeared to her in Brooklyn when she was very depressed on a winter day, and it was cold and rainy and dreary outside, and this figure in Oriental garb comes to her to encourage her, to tell her that she's right to be concerned about the fate of the world, and that he's going to take her on as a student. And she writes that this was the beginning of her theosophical journey. So there's so many aspects. These letters then lead to so many different ways of understanding them and interpreting them and interpreting this character and his importance to people like Laura, who were interested in theosophy and in occult studies. And this character, Kuthomi, as I write in the book, becomes an important character in alternative religious thought, continuing sort of New Age thought into our time, so that there are still portraits being painted of him, there's still images of him, which more and more have become to resemble images of Jesus. The two have become conflated in a lot of the New Age literature.
You have an image in the book that kind of brings that very much visually to the
yes,
fore.
Yes, and Laura herself, maybe we're jumping a little bit ahead here,
yeah.
But Laura herself was the medium through which the description of Kuthomi came for a German painter to paint him.
Mm.
And that painting, the image in that painting, is very much like German images of Jesus of the 19th century, of other German painters. But it was Laura's description, her psychic abilities that were able to visualize him and describe him to the painter. So there's a direct connection to Laura here, to that the way that image has, has been passed
mm-hmm.
down.
Mm-hmm. We will come back and talk in a little bit more detail about Theosophy, the Theosophical movement, the events of 1884, and the significance for her life. But I wanted to back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the Nashville portion of her life, since that's what caught you early on when you were doing other research and you found out, oh, this person is from Nashville. You talk about how formative the experience that she had in Nashville was for her life. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of those formative experiences that happened in Nashville that kind of that we see kind of unfolding in the rest of her life.
Laura grew up in Nashville before the Civil War. She was Laura Carter, a member of a well-known family in this area. Her father, however, was not, as she later described him, a wealthy plantation owner. He actually helped run racetracks and gambling around Nashville and was proprietor of a couple of hotels. The hotels are interesting and important, I think, in Laura's life because Nashville was a lot more cosmopolitan than we might envision it in the 1840s and the 1850s. It was on the river, and it was a prosperous town, and it was a center for culture and the arts. So famous actors, famous opera stars, singers, performers passed through and performed in theater in Nashville, and they stayed at Laura's father's hotel. And she there was exposed to people from outside of Nashville and outside of the South, people that she met there at the hotel, so that she was not living a protected, isolated Southern Belle life on a plantation mm-hmm. somewhere. She was, at least in part of her life, living in downtown Nashville, not far from the Capitol. What would be now Church and Fifth Street. The hotel was on the corner of Church and Fifth Street. She was a student at the Nashville Female Academy, which is now, I think, down where the YMCA building is, down on Church Street, and she would walk from her home to the Nashville Female Academy. But the Nashville Female Academy was touted as the largest school for young ladies in the South, or in the nation, in the nation at the time. And it was a boarding school as well as a day school. Laura was a day student, but young women from good families all over the South came to the Nashville Female Academy to study. And it brought in faculty, some of whom were trained in Europe. It was rather an amazing education for young women of the time, where Laura studied German, I think she studied French, she studied music with people who were trained in Paris. So she got a very fine education at the Nashville Female Academy. But the two most formative events in her life, I think, came a bit later, and one was the Civil War. And the war really hangs over her whole life, mm-hmm. The trauma of the war. And the second was the trauma of a marriage, which is also connected to the war, because Nashville, as you know, was taken over by the Union forces, occupied by Union forces quite early on. And Union forces set up their headquarters of some of the officers at her father's hotel. And there she met a young Union officer named Junius B. Holloway. And after knowing him for a very short time, they were married. The marriage seemed to have been a disaster from the beginning. Junius Holloway was a disreputable character who was imprisoned both by the Union and by the Confederate forces, and accused of spying. And at one point, Laura is appealing to Andrew Johnson, who is the military governor of Tennessee, to get her husband out of jail. So a good part of their marriage, it seems, Junius was either wandering around as a spy or in jail somewhere. But they were married long enough to Laura to give birth to a son named George. So the marriage, it's hard to know how long it lasted, anywhere from a year to a couple of years, but not very long. And for Laura, that was completely traumatic. All of her ideas about what a woman's life would be, about what her life would be, were shattered. The war also took away much of her family wealth because her father, Samuel Carter, is an interesting character, was both a Union supporter. He opposed secession of Tennessee from the Union, but he was a slaveholder. And he was also an opponent of abolition. And he did not believe after the war in African-American equal rights. So he was a complicated character. In a lot of ways, his positions were very close to those of Andrew Johnson. Laura herself had been a Confederate supporter early on, and then seems to have, there's an anecdote of her standing on the hotel porch and spitting at the Union troops, and they are arresting her she makes forgotten the exact words, but defamation of Andrew Johnson. And they try to arrest her, and Andrew Johnson says, Samuel Carter's pretty young daughter, don't bother with her. She'll put flowers on my grave, which she does eventually. So I'll get back to the marriage, but the connection with Andrew Johnson was very important. So this is, in a way, a formative connection for her, because she did know the man who became the future president of the United States. He, as I said, stayed in her father's hotels and had been staying there for when he was governor of Tennessee and probably when he was in the state legislature in Tennessee. They kept a room for him at her father's hotels. And then even when he was president, before the Carters left Tennessee, Johnson would ask Samuel Carter to get him some of that good Tennessee whiskey and send it to the White House. So they kept in touch. So Johnson becomes Laura's patron, and she knows the Johnson family. She knows Johnson's daughter from Tennessee, and because of these connections, then a few years later, when she was struggling to try to find a way to support herself as a single mother after the failure of her marriage, she was able to call on those connections with the president and ask the president's help in writing the book, Ladies of the White House. So Andrew Johnson had his staff send out letters under the president's stationery and name to relatives of former presidents and first ladies, recommending Laura to them, giving her entree to these people who then shared with her correspondence and documents and oral history about the first ladies of the White House. So without the Johnson connection, she might never have had a career as a writer. This really jump-started her career. And once that book, which was sold by subscription, was very popular, sold a lot of copies, and she became known as the author of Ladies of the White House. And that then was the beginning of her career as a literary figure. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should go back to the marriage for just a minute. Yeah, sure. Because this, I think,
really affected her views
tremendously. Right. what she learned from the failure of this marriage, and a lesson that she, for better or worse, took with her for the rest of her life, is that you can never trust men, right? And never let yourself be subsumed to the authority of a man or the control of a man, particularly economic control. Because by 1866, her family decided to leave Nashville. Her father had run on the radical Republican ticket for Congress. He was badly beaten. He was seen as a scallywag, a Union supporter, not a popular position to take in Nashville after the war, immediately after the war. Her younger brothers were evidently not allowed to attend schools here because of her father's political positions. The family was pretty much bankrupt. A lot of her father's wealth had been tied up in slave ownership. So with emancipation, he lost his wealth. So his businesses had gone under. They were really destitute. And her marriage had failed. So her parents, along with her younger siblings, Laura, and her son, George, who at the time that left Nashville was 3 to 4 years old, left Nashville for New York. And at that point, Samuel Carter, even though Laura appealed to Andrew Johnson to get him a job, he never really seemed to work or was able to support his family after that. And it was left up to the children to support the family. And Laura is one of the oldest, felt that burden tremendously. And so she felt the need to go out and to work. And she was really quite bitter about the fact that she felt women were not prepared. They were not told that they might need to be self-sufficient. They were not educated to be able to get jobs. They were taught music by French music masters. They were not taught the skills to go into the workplace. And this becomes a theme of her whole life, the need for women's economic independence. So her feminism, I think, originated with those traumatic events, both the war, but particularly the failure of the marriage. And her feeling, and she wrote about this in short stories, not directly. She never wrote about these things directly under her own name. It would always be in fiction or in poetry or anonymously. But she felt she blamed mothers for not telling their daughters about the realities that they may face, not giving them or letting them have the education that they would need to be self-supporting. And so one of the themes of her life from this point on is the need for women to receive education, for women to be able to work and support themselves, for women not to be in the position of being bartered for economic security in marriage, that she felt that marriage, women were married off by their fathers in order for them to have economic security. She thought that was something that no woman should ever have to endure. So she became hostile, really, toward the institution of marriage from that point on, and really a very strong advocate for women's economic independence.
Yeah, one interesting thing, she wasn't unique, I'm sure, but she didn't support suffrage for women. And you talk a little bit about that after the portion of the family moved to New York. She got involved in a lot of writing and journalism. She was doing public lectures, and she really enraged some people.
Susan B. Anthony. And yes.
So what, you know, how did that fit into her?
Yes, and what how she enraged them was, and this, I think, points to your question, is that she argued that women need not wait for suffrage in order to claim their agency. In other words, her opinion was they should just get on with it. And she didn't have much confidence in political process, in politics. Now, whether this goes back to to political experience that she observed in Nashville, I don't know about that. But she really did not see that suffrage in and of itself would remedy women's oppression or give them freedom. That suffrage wouldn't answer the issues that she saw as crucial, and that was that it was the institution of marriage and women's economic dependence that were the problems. That if women had economic independence, they would not be forced into marriage. If they had economic independence, they could make decisions for themselves. And suffrage, if it came, fine. If it didn't, they still could claim their own agency and their own freedom. Well, this was not something that supporters of suffrage were very happy about her saying. And she always tried to play both ends. She was very careful to try not to offend the suffragists, but she was also very careful to in public at least, not to offend true women and opponents of suffrage. So she played it very carefully in public. But I think basically at the root of it was that she didn't see politics as the remedy for for issues of women's equality. She looked to other ways for equality.
I want to turn again, sort of back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation, which is, you know, the subtitle of your book, Late Victorian Spirituality, and ask you first to talk a little bit about what late Victorian spirituality in the United States was like. I mean, what kinds of things were going on that Laura Holloway Langford sort of plugged into and then worked with in her own way?
I think that she was typical of a lot of religious seekers in the second half of the 19th century, and that she was deeply influenced by transcendentalism. Whether or not she would point to it herself, I think that the transcendentalist movement was very prominently influential among religious progressives and people looking for rigid religious alternatives. She, like transcendentalists, and this I think connects with what I've said before about her attitude toward marriage, really believed that social institution hindered self-development, and that the individual's task was to develop themselves morally and spiritually, as well as intellectually, and that religious institutions in particular were a hindrance, not a help, to that self-development, and that it was individual effort, individual will, individual confidence in their own abilities and the divine spark within, that divinity, you could look for divinity within any human being. So in that sense, I mean, these were very common ideas in the 19th century that she that resonated with her. She was also very much a religious perfectionist. So again, the strain of religious perfectionism that we see is part of American Protestantism that is certainly exemplified by the Shakers, who believe that you could live a perfect life. That was very much part of her own religious perspective, that by individual effort and individual will and individual commitment, one could attain perfection, perhaps, or close to perfection, and the goal was to obtain perfection. Part of this was a rejection of the whole Calvinist notion of sin and the need for redemption and the need for salvation. So that was completely among this kind of religious seeker, and was characteristic of late Victorian spirituality, that was a discarding those notions of sin and the need for redemption from sin, discarding the notion of the need for the atonement or Jesus as a divine figure even. And so moving beyond that to a notion that divinity rests within all people, and that there is a unity of all people, that all people are part of this divine, a divine unity. And the transcendentalists, as you know, were some of the first to become interested in Eastern religions. And so again, there is that connection, because the notion of the unity of God and of all people as being part of the unity of God, of course, is reinforced by her contact with Eastern religious traditions. And Eastern religious traditions became increasingly known and increasingly popular in America, spirituals, among American spiritual seekers, and not in the mainstream perhaps, but among the circles that Laura Holloway moved in, were attracted to, many of them were attracted to Eastern religious traditions. So she was also, I would say that the notion of universalism, which again is became prominent in the latter part of the 19th century. She was a universalist in a little different sense. It was not that Christ offered universal salvation to everyone, because she discarded the notion that you needed salvation from Christ. That had long gone by the way. But a universalism in the sense that all religions contained universal truths. and that there were universal truths that found expression in different languages, different cultures, different sacred texts, different histories, but in essence, they were all the same. So though you may be on different paths, the mountaintop, you will be all heading toward the same, you'll all head toward the same mountaintop. So that it did not matter, really. It was not that she would be anti-Christian. You could be a Christian and find those universal truths within Christianity. Though, as you progressed on that path, you probably realized that you could leave some of the trappings of Orthodox Christianity behind, right? And the same with other religious traditions. But that, so there was an acceptance of multiple religious traditions. It wasn't as if she became a Buddhist, it meant that she rejected Christianity. There was the sense that you could be all of these things at the same time, so that she could be a spiritualist. She could be, in some sense, a Christian, although certainly not a traditional Christian. She could be a theosophist, a Buddhist, all of these, and perhaps even a Shaker sister, in some sense, simultaneously, that they were not contradictory, that they were all part of universal religion.
And but she for a while anyway, she becomes connected to one particular group that comes out of this late Victorian spirituality, which is the Theosophical Society. And a good bit of your book is devoted to that, and unfortunately we can't go into great detail about it. I mean, you go into quite a lot of detail about this particularly this time when she's in Europe in 1884. But I wonder if you could, I have a couple of questions about this, and the first is, could you talk a little bit about the Theosophical Society? You've mentioned the Theosophical Society, you've mentioned theosophy a number of times. Could you talk a little bit about what that means for those of us who aren't theosophists, and talk a little bit about who was involved in the society? Again, you've mentioned a few of the names, but if you could give a little bit more detail.
The Theosophical Society was formed in New York in 1875. The leader, although she was never head of the society, was Helena Blavatsky, a Russian who was charismatic, who was extremely imaginative, had an enormous religious imagination, the way that I would put it, and an enormous ability to retain information. So, Blavatsky had some followers who were interested in the occult. And so it really in the beginning grew out of spiritualism. These were people who were going to seances and spiritualist occurrences. And Henry Alcott met Blavatsky at one of these. And he and a small group of other people decided that they would form a society to study occult phenomena and psychic phenomena. So the beginning of this was out of spiritualism, although the Theosophical Society and Blavatsky pretty quickly distanced themselves and tried to distinguish themselves from spiritualism. One of the initial founders of the society was a young man named William Quan Judge, who was an Irish immigrant and a lawyer, who had married a pious Methodist, and who was very much interested in the occult. And it was William Quan Judge who first introduced Laura Holloway to the Theosophical Society. But before that point, Alcott and Blavatsky had decided they were not really making very much progress in the United States. They had, after a few years, only something like 150 members of the society, most of whom were around the New York area. And they decided that they would remove the society's headquarters to India and form an alliance with Hindu reform movements in India. And it was really in India that the Theosophical Society began to gain large numbers of converts and really took off as an organization. But that's a whole other story. In the meantime, William Quan Judge had stayed in New York because he was married. His wife would not agree to go to India with him. He had a child who died of diphtheria, which was a very traumatic experience for him. And he had said that he would not leave for India as long as the child was alive, but even after her death, he felt a responsibility to his wife who would not agree to go. But he met Laura Holloway probably in 1883. They were participating in spiritualist activities. There was a small group that seemed to meet on Sunday nights to try to contact the spirits. And I suspect that Judge looked to Holloway to be his medium, as to be the intermediary to contact spirits. But he told her about Theosophy and the Theosophical Societies. Now, one of the basic tenets of Theosophy is that there is ancient wisdom that has been preserved in very remote places, that over the centuries, that other religious traditions have suppressed that, sometimes deliberately, or distorted it. It has become distorted in the religious traditions that we know are new in the 19th century. So there may be glimmers or germs of the truth in those traditions, but for the most part, it's distorted. But somewhere, the true essence of those traditions is preserved. And that then takes us back to the Mahatmas, who are those ancient beings who have lived for centuries and who have preserved those traditions. Well, this idea was new to Laura. I don't know that she had heard about this. She may have read a little bit about newspaper accounts about Blavatsky and Olcott, so she may have had some inkling of this, but it was really through Judge that she first began to learn about these Mahatmas and the fact that they communicated with human beings through letters, and that there was an Anglo-Indian theosophist named Alfred Percy Sinnett, who had received such communications from Kuthomi and other Mahatmas, and who wrote some important books based on these communications. And in fact, Laura reviewed, I think, one of them for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. Anyway, through Judge, she becomes interested in Theosophy. But there is also a subtext here, and that is the relationship between Laura and William Quan Judge. At this point, Laura had lost her job at the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, and it's unclear why, but she may have been fired by a new editor because she was a woman who didn't want a woman in the newsroom. Judge was desperate to get out of New York and go to India and join the Theosophists. And the two of them decided that they had been compatriots in a previous life in Egypt, and they were calling up these stories from the spirits, and that they were destined to go together and to have careers as occultists and work for the Theosophical Society. So Judge left first. He went to Europe and met with Blavatsky, who approved Laura coming. And then Laura set sail. For first she was in Paris and then in London, and joined Blavatsky, who had come from India, and Olcott had come from India, coming to France, Germany, England, in order to try to shore up the young theosophical societies in those countries and to expand the movement in Europe. So Blavatsky was looking for ways to appeal to Europeans, to appeal to the West. Theosophy, the Theosophical Society, was being very successful in India, but not so successful in Western countries. So when the possibility of Laura joining, and she had joined the society already, but coming to Europe, and Blavatsky heard these stories about what a wonderful writer she was and how talented she was, and she was a psychic. And I think Blavatsky decided, aha, here's somebody I can use as a writer who will know how to put Theosophy in terms that will appeal to Europeans and Americans. So Blavatsky wanted to employ her as a scribe, basically, as a writer for her in Europe. And then the story gets complicated because Laura stepped into the middle of power struggles between British theosophists, investigations by the Society for Psychic Research in England that were going on, and interviews of members of the Theosophical Society. And so she had no idea about the politics of the Theosophical Society, but found herself immersed in these internecine struggles that ended up that she, although she had hoped to be a disciple, accepted as a disciple of Kuthomi Blavatsky Center Packing by October. By the fall, she was sent back home to New York and was remembered among Theosophists as a failed disciple of the Theosophical Society. More than you wanted to know.
No, well, I mean, and the book goes into more detail, so you've done an amazing job of summarizing it. What were some of the lasting influences that this trip had for her? Because it occupies a central portion of your book, so it's obviously important. For the rest of her life, how does she?
Yeah, I think she struggled for the rest of her life with whether she had failed, and if so, she had failed. How had she failed? She never, as far as I could tell, questioned the essence of the theosophical notion of the Mahatmas or ancient wisdom. It's very hard to tell with her, though, because she was so self-protective in what she revealed about herself. But at least publicly, she never questioned Blavatsky, even after Blavatsky was labeled as a fraud, even after there was evidence of Blavatsky's manipulations within the Theosophical Society. She was loyal always to Blavatsky and to the Mahatmas. She used the material that she, and the experience that she had in that summer, for a good bit of writing. So she was able to parlay it into some profit to herself. I think that Judge and other Theosophists realized that she had this knack for taking anything that she could find and using it to her own advantage and for her own profit. And she did that with Theosophical material to some extent. On the other hand, she could have written an expose of the society. She could have been one of those who would have made a splash, as many other Theosophists did, by exposing Blavatsky or denouncing Theosophy. She never did that. So although she used that material to some extent, she never did what she possibly could have done, because I argue that she was for a very short time initiated into some of the inner secrets of the communications from Kuthomi. And so I think there were things she knew that she could have used to her advantage, but she did not. But I think that the experience itself really led to a lot of self-doubt on her part for a period of time about her own spiritual ability. She believed she was a psychic, and she believed very strongly in her psychic abilities. But she was burned by that experience, so that she became even more protective from that point on, and she did not want to be known as a psychic. She did not want to be associated publicly with the Theosophical Society. So privately, she continued occult studies. Privately, she continued as interest in Theosophy. To the very last year of her life, she was subscribing to many occult publications and reading them and underlining them and taking notes on them. So she never lost the interest, but publicly she distanced herself. And I think that in this, after the Theosophical Society, she stopped her membership in the Theosophical Society in the late 1880s, but within a short time after coming back to the United States. I think the Shakers, then sort of her association with the Shakers in her own mind, helped rehabilitate her reputation. Both as a woman of integrity, because Blavatsky, association with Blavatsky in many circles in the United States was considered, she was considered to be a loose woman, a disreputable woman, so association with her was not something that would enhance your status among middle class Americans. Mm. And Laura was always very conscious of her social status, did not want to do anything to undermine her social status. So she distanced herself publicly from Blavatsky, from the society, even though privately, I think that she continued to very strongly believe in Theosophy.
Let's turn to the Shakers, since you've brought them up, and since they also occupy a good bit of the closing chapters of your book. She had a relatively long, fairly intimate relationship with this particular family of Shakers in New York, I mean, she wrote about them. She tried to convince them to do some things that she wanted them to do on their property. She herself bought property from them. So how did her spirituality, her gender-related concerns influence her to get connected with the Shakers, drive this connection, but also end up causing contention and problems?
I think she was first attracted to the Shakers because of mutual interest in spiritualism. Mm. Particularly the North family Shakers were spiritualists. And in the 1870s, they participated in spiritualist conventions. And I think Laura attended one of these in New York, where she heard a Shaker elderess, Antoinette Doolittle, speak very strongly in favor of women's rights, a very strong feminist statement. So I think it was those two aspects of Shakerism that attracted Laura to them, the belief in a spiritual world and with communication that's possible between this world and the spiritual world. And that if you progress spiritually, you become closer and closer, even while in this world, to that spirit world. So the veil between, I'm using the spiritualist language mm-hmm. here, but the veil between is lifted, and those two worlds become almost one in communication. So this was very attractive to Laura. I'm back up just a minute to mm-hmm. say that one of the differences in Eastern religious thought and alternative spirituality in the Victorian period that we're talking about is that in Eastern religious thought, no, there is no individuality of the person that survives into the beyond this life. You merge with something larger, with the divine, but the individual personality, the individual does not persist. In Laura's thought, which is, in root Christian thought, and in Shaker thought, the individual persists. You can recognize those individuals in the spirit world. You can recognize your mother. You can recognize the former Shaker leader. And when they send messages to you, those messages will be individualized. Mm. So this aspect of Shakerism was much closer to the way Laura thought about the spiritual world than the way the Theosophists might or Eastern religions might think about a spiritual world. So in that way, Shakerism was very compatible to her with her interest in spiritualism. But it was the feminism, what she saw as Shaker feminism, that I think was also crucial in developing this very close relationship with the Shakers. Shakers believed in celibacy, and they lived communally, but men and women together communally, but celibate, and they had a dual structure of governance. So in theory, men and women were equal, had equal offices, equal power, equal governance, both religiously and materially in the Shaker communities. And this, to Laura, was very appealing. She developed a very close relationship with Anna White, as I've said before, the North family Shakers. For the Shakers' part, they, sort of like Blavatsky, they were could see advantages in having a good friend who was a journalist and a writer. So the Shakers looked to Laura to help present them, shape their image in the press, to write articles on specific issues that came up involving the Shakers. And Laura did that. But the Shakers could never control how Laura portrayed them, and she did not always portray them the way they hoped to be portrayed, because she was a very strong-headed person with her own ideas about things, about how the Theosophical Society should be run and about how Shaker Society should be run. And that did not always sit well with all Shakers. And one of the things that she advocated all of her life was concerned about homeless children, about the fate of children whose parents had been killed, who were orphans. I think this, again, goes back to the Civil War experience, so that formative experience, because this was a concern that she had from the early 1870s. She was the first person to propose what is called the Fresh Air
Fund.
And
I thought that was amazing.
Yes, yes. It's attributed to some man later from some newspaper, but she had done it years before, right? She organized it with the Brooklyn Daily Union to raise money for children, orphans, and poor working children from the city to have holidays to the beach. Children who were working 7 days a week, she got the their bosses to give them a day off in the summer or 2 days off in the summer so they could have a holiday at the beach. So her idea was the Shaker communities were declining. There were all these empty buildings. Why didn't they bring all these homeless children in from New York and from the cities and give them homes and provide schools for them? Well, that was not the Shaker mission. And so there was this conflict over her ideas about what Shakers should be doing to remedy the world, to ameliorate the world, where Shakers saw their mission as a spiritual mission, not as a mission to reform the world socially. So there was that conflict. But I think as time went on, and particularly toward the end of her relationship with the Shakers, there was one particular conflict that made her realize that the Shaker sisters did not have the autonomy or the control within the society that in theory she thought they had, or the Shakers had, would say that they had in theory. In practice, it did not always work out that way, and particularly when it came to control of land and property and financial control of the finances of the society, it was the men who controlled those things. Even though by the early part of the 19th century, the women outnumbered the men, there were just a few men left, nevertheless, it was the men who would make those kinds of decisions. And one of the men who was making those kinds of decisions was an incompetent. Not to mention, probably more than incompetent, it probably had delved into some sleazy and unethical financial and real estate practices. But he, at one point, Laura, came into conflict over what was called the Anley Cottage, which was a one of the Shaker buildings that was being used as a boarding house for religious seekers, mainly women who came in the summer to spend the summer on the Shaker property. And this had been Laura's idea. They ran it successfully for 1 year, and she was making plans for the second year when a Shaker named Robert Valentine decided that he wanted the property to use for his dairy and said no. And the Shaker sisters couldn't do anything about it. Well, Laura was just enraged and evidently went into a Shaker meeting, confronted him head on, and there was a to-do about it. And she became rather disillusioned, I think, with the with whether theory and reality about sexual equality in the Shaker communities really meshed. And so from that, and then there were conflicts over property that she had bought and financial conflicts with the Shakers that embittered her even more after Anna White's death. But she came to feel that the Shakers, let me see how I can put this, she would have no problem with giving up sex. Celibacy was not the issue. For her, celibacy was a way to woman's freedom. Getting rid of marriage, and even if it entailed getting rid of sexual experience altogether, was okay if it's what it took for women's freedom. But to give up your economic autonomy, that was another issue. And when you became a Shaker, you went into you gave up all property, all personal possessions, everything became communal. And she realized that it became communal under, ultimately, the control of men. That, to her, was completely unacceptable. And I think she did argue, that as long as Shakers kept up that economic system, they were not going to have a chance of expanding, that they would continue to decline. So I think it was the economic issue. Because for her, economics was the central issue for feminists. And for that reason, she, although the Shakers hoped for many years that she would become a Shaker, they called her Sister Laura, many of them, some of them considered her sort of a quasi-member of the society, but I think she would never have agreed to live with communal property. To her, that would have been not security, but a kind of insecurity, not having her own financial resources. So, you know, it's ironic that she ends the end of her life in poverty, living on a, on the Shaker, former Shaker farm in Deep Poverty.
I mean, there are a number of other questions I like to ask, but I think we're going to have to come to a close. But I did want to ask one final question. You write that, and this is a quote, Laura Holloway Langford's spiritual journey was a solitary undertaking. Spiritualism and theosophy provided neither a lasting community nor opportunity for leadership. Among the Shakers, however, Laura found a depth of friendship that sustained her spirit. Even so, she resisted living their communal life. In the end, her desire to transform the world had to be satisfied by a personal quest for a new age of individual perfection, unquote. So as you indicate in this quote and throughout the book, Laura Holloway Langford is a product of a complex interaction with various communities. She draws from the energies of the communities, but she also resists being too closely affiliated with them. To what extent is this, can this just be looked, seen as a product of her own circumstances, which I think you've talked about a bit, but also looking beyond Laura Holloway Langford, how do you see this ambivalence resonating today in the way that spiritual seekers, religious people relate, don't relate to communities?
I think the strongly individualistic strain in her story is one that continues among religious seekers and among Protestantism in the 20th century. And in the book, I mentioned Robert Bellah's Habits of the Heart as a critique of that kind of individualism. And I think it's she's very much in that strain of, I've emphasized the feeling that she had of the importance of agency and autonomy. And as part of that was a resistance to authority. Whether that is religious authority, whether it's the authority of Kutomi, or whatever authority it may be, and particularly if that authority is male authority. So for Laura, a part of the story is a particularly 19th century, maybe, or early 20th century story, when religious institutions were dominated by men, and when even the Theosophical Society she was part of it, when it was dominated by men, and when there was really not a clear avenue for women's leadership in the society. That changed with Annie Besant a little bit later on, but in the time that she was there, there was no clear avenue for women. So that may have changed to some extent as the decades have gone on, but maybe not entirely. So for women, it was a particular problem whether to become part of a community would mean subsuming oneself to male authority. But Laura's individualism was also a kind of assertion of belief in her own, in the self, and herself, and the individual self, and the ability of the individual self to make judgments for itself about religious matters. And that may mean being eclectic in a way that purists would find really distressing, not horrifying. Robert Bellah might find horrifying. But believing that there was nothing wrong in picking and choosing what resonated with the individual self, what seemed to nourish that the spiritual search of that particular person. And nothing wrong with that not being the same from one person to another. that was perfectly fine. And I think that is characteristic of a lot of what we call spiritual, as opposed to when we use the word religious these days, we're really talking usually about institutional religions or formal organizations, and people use that word spiritual, which I feel a little ambivalent about myself. But I mean, that is a word that Laura would have used. and that's a word that is, of course, is a very common and common usage today. But I think there's one aspect of that is that there is still that belief in the primacy of the self, the emotions of the self, the perceptions of the self, that there is the divine in some way can be manifest in the self, and that that individual self is capable of discerning the divine outside the strictures of institutions or outside the bounds of any sacred text and any sacred tradition. So I think that I think Laura's story in that way is very, her spirituality is in some ways similar to what we talk about today as, you know, as spiritual seekers today. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that is...
that's a wonderful answer. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for the larger conversation we've had. I'm sorry we couldn't go into even more things, but we leave that to the listener to seek out Diane's book.
We left out the fiction. We left out the Zydal Society.
Yes, so many things. Again, I've been talking with Diane Sasson about her recent book, Yearning for the New Age: Laura Holloway Langford and Late Victorian Spirituality, which was recently published by Indiana University Press in the Religion in North America series. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.